Now to my guest, standing by, Professor Charlene Spretnak. She is an internationally recognized author and was among the first wave of women originators behind what is now called ecofeminism. And her writings have focused on everything from social justice, ecological philosophy, green politics, feminism, spirituality, and religion. And she is the author of Relational Reality. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
We recently had Elizabeth Satoris, and I went out to California to film her, and we filmed for about 3 hours. She was just one of the most remarkable women, and I believe at that time she mentioned that we should have you on the show. I don't know if you know her. Do you know her?
Yes, I do know her.
Okay.
And I was on your show many, many, many years ago. But,
I know. It's been a while.
Listening to your introductory talk about the political situation, I'm not sure you know I'm a co-founder of the Green Party in this country, and my book Green Politics was sort of a catalyst in 1984 for that founding convention. So we could have a wonderful talk about that sometime.
Well,
but
good.
Actually, the book Relational Reality is very much related to the whole analysis and vision behind the Green Platform, although it's applicable to all kinds of directions.
I'm going to take the opportunity to read a short paragraph from your book, Relational Reality, as a jumping-off point for you to please discuss with us some of the things that we should know and some of the myths. And here's what you say. It has now been more than 100 years since Einstein's first two articles established that the universe is best understood as a highly relational rather than mechanistic. Wouldn't one expect a post-mechanistic worldview to spread from science into society at a far more rapid pace in the 20th century than did the previous comparable shift? Instead, the implications of the new physics have hardly affected society's way of thinking, perhaps because people find them too abstract to be relevant to daily life. In the 1980s and 90s, complexity studies in biology and other areas of science discovered that dynamic interrelatedness is the key to understanding living systems. The implications of those discoveries, too, had some impact beyond science, but did not really have a significant impact on the mainstream. Similarly, the emergence of alternative medicine, now called integral or integrated medicine, made some waves as it was grudgingly but increasingly accepted by the medical system, unquote. So when I look at our institutions today and the policies and practices they enact, I see very little acknowledgement of relational causative factors. And a couple of examples, the elite on Wall Street are simply unable to understand how casino investment relates to the collapse of the middle class and increased poverty in the U.S. And then, of course, Washington rewards mechanistic views. So could you take us on this look and show us how you see this world and why we are not more integrated, interrelated, and what we need to get there?
Yes. Well, the passage you wrote was related to this question I've always wondered about, because after the scientific revolution reached its culmination at the end of the 17th century, in only 100 years, all the social institutions in France and England were redesigned on the mechanistic model. So I've always wondered why it's taken more than 100 years, as you say, since Einstein's first papers, for us to get off the mechanistic model and onto a corrected relational sense of reality, because that's what actually matches the findings. So I thought it just wasn't going to happen in my lifetime. I thought perhaps the news out of physics was too abstract for people to really absorb, and also from complexity studies. And then around 2004, I started noticing in the daily newspaper small articles about discoveries, new discoveries, often in physiology, that were very concrete, very accessible, and happening in mainstream venues with successful applications. So this was a surprise to me, and I started tracking it, and that is how I came up with scores and scores of these discoveries, mostly from the past 10 years, which I think are going to move things because, as I say, they're not marginal and they're not abstract. So quite a number of them are in the area you're most familiar with, that is health and healthcare. But they're even surprising to people in that area, because if I had told you some of these, or if I'd read them myself 10 years ago, certainly all physiologists would have said, no, that's impossible. But in fact, now we see it's not at all impossible. For instance, researchers in 2007 found that for people of all ages, 10 minutes of talking with someone, either in person or on the phone, boosts mental performance and memory as much as doing crossword puzzles for the same amount of time. Moreover, it was found that the more social contact people have, the higher their level of mental functioning. So this was not suspected. And personal relationships, social relationships, of course, in the biomechanistic model are just off on the side somewhere. The number of friends you have couldn't be more irrelevant to your physical health, it was thought, and still is in many quarters. And by now, we've heard from our doctors, you know, that what you need to stay well is eat well, get enough sleep, the usual litany, and at the end, they'll usually tack on, and have some friends and socialize. But that one little tacked-on bit really challenges the entire biomechanistic model they were schooled in. So it's going to change more and more. And another study in 2009 found that elderly adults with fewer friendships and other social interactions experienced not only a higher risk for dementia, but a more rapid decline in motor function, such as walking, gripping, and balancing. I mean, we are so inherently interrelated, and we don't even understand our own nature in this hypermodern society. That's what's really exciting about these recent discoveries, because, as I say, they're so concrete and accessible, they're really going to push this more into the mainstream.
Could you focus on one area that I'm particularly interested in? And I know from your background you are. I'll start with just a thought from Albert Einstein. He said that any intelligent fool can make things bigger, more complex, and more violent. It takes a touch of genius and a lot of courage to move in the opposite direction. But then he added, only two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the former. That said, could you please spend some time now on nature? We are told has no substantial or quantifiable relationship to human health and healing, and that's why we don't have to be as concerned about using its resources and depleting it. Please explore that issue with us.
Yes, well, as I say, listening to your opening talk there, I can see you've probably talked to the listeners quite a bit about the political forces behind keeping that off the table. And on the other hand, it's just becoming more and more obvious that the connection is there. A connection between nature and us? Well, for one thing, if you've ever worked in an office and you were moving into a new space and the maintenance people, the plant people come and say, what kind of light do you want in here, lady? You know, what do you want, incandescent? Do you want fluorescent? It doesn't matter to us. Light is light. Well, that is so untrue, because it's been found now that buildings are being daylighted, as it's called in architecture, more and more, that we have a very special relationship with the natural light of the sun. And people who are in offices that are lighted by natural light have less illness, less absenteeism. They feel better, as they do if there's even one plant in the office. In surveys, they report that they feel more satisfied with their work, but with life in general. And for women, having colorful flowers in the room makes a difference with mood and well-being, which is probably from our gatherer-hunter phase when women were discovering which plants and blooms did various things for us for hundreds of thousands of years. At any rate, it doesn't have the same effect on men, the flowers in the room, but plants help everyone. And there was an interesting study done a couple of years ago, 2009. People were shown two different sets of slides at different times. People shown slides of entirely man-made environments or human-made were surveyed after the slideshow, and they ranked money, fame, and or power as the highest values. But people who were shown slides of nature photography afterward ranked caring, generosity, and personal relationships and community as their prime values. So we could conclude that nature enables us to be our true, caring, generous, and expansive selves. It seems to free us of self-absorption, disengagement, and diminished empathy, which is becoming intensified as this hyper-modern trajectory picks up speed. And then, of course, there's a section showing clearly the fact, as you say, of the toxins on our system. It's just absurd to say that has no effect on us, and chemical industry can go on putting out as many untested chemicals as they feel like, because now, as no doubt you've mentioned to your audience, babies in this country are born with almost 300 chemicals in their umbilical blood. They tested that a few years ago, and 209 of them were industrial chemicals that had never been found before. So, I don't know if you probably remember Dr. Rosalie Bertels and the sure. peace movement in the early 80s and her wonderful phrase, her prognosis. She said the prognosis for the human species is slow death by poisoning. So we need strong regulation to address that, and we don't have it right now. But the evidence of the correlation is absolutely irrefutable.
Let's follow up on that. I think for those of us who follow climate change, real science, and not denialism, and also observe how modern nations are addressing the problem and long-term crisis that humanity will confront, perhaps much sooner, I believe, we are shocked at the low priority it is being given to make those important, hard decisions to avoid a sudden cascade of catastrophes, which seem to be mounting. So I would like to hear you speak on how humans could shift into a relational reality with the environment and even the climate changes of global warming we are now experiencing. And do you have any solutions you would offer for individuals to prepare and confront these changes?
Well, I think individual lifestyle changes are important, but we have to have systemic change. And so in this book, Relational Reality, I'm talking about all these new discoveries with relation to what works in parenting, what works in education, what works in health and healing. And then I go into the areas of what's working in architecture and community design, and then what's working in the economy, the political economy. There's really a growing awareness of how we need to rethink living in place. And in the Green Party over the years, we had this model of building up community-based economics so the money circulates largely in your town or city or region without going out immediately to distant corporate headquarters. And we could never quite figure out the catalyst for how to get this model across. But the catalyst turned out to be food. It turned out to be the growth of the farmers' markets during the 1990s and beyond, which are now pretty much everywhere. And from that, seeing the local businesses, people have started thinking about not only local food business, but supporting other kinds of local businesses and having a green belt of farms, having food security in every town and city so you're not vulnerable to what happens far away. So this kind of thinking has really been seeded at the grassroots, and people are talking more and more about it, especially with that reckless gambling that, as you noted, caused the collapse in 2008, to decentralize more and have more regional economies, so you're not so dependent on the gambling gains on Wall Street. I think it's very important to push candidates on these issues, but again, as you no doubt have made the point, nothing is really going to change substantively until we get campaign finance reform, because the system is so corrupt now. I mean, the most wonderful, upstanding person might go into Congress or state legislature, and especially in Congress, they have to hustle those donations from the big donors. I'm not sure most people understand that the U.S. Congress only does business 3 days a week now. It's only in session from Tuesday morning till Thursday night.
Charlene, that is true until we only have one term of 3 years per person and no campaign.
Well, that's the other way. We've done that in California, and you know, you do lose experience. But to get money out of the system so every vote isn't bought, because I was going to say they have to get on a plane Thursday and go back home and hustle money, and the party tells them how much they have to bring in every month. So either somebody has to go and say, look, I'm here for one term, I don't need that money, or what worked so well is the clean money, clean elections experiments in Arizona and Maine. And even all the state-level candidates, 7 out of 9 in Arizona, 2 years after it went into effect, were elected on clean money. And both parties said, we really like this. We get to go talk to grassroots groups instead of just rich people. And it's worked so well that you would think it was going to trickle up, but instead, the moneyed powers have lawsuits challenging it and trying to get it rolled back.
And they control the media. My last question today, and I'm hopeful you'll come back to talk about the environment on another program where we can devote a full hour to it, is I have a question that harkens back to some of your earlier research and writing regarding feminism and women's spirituality. I personally think it is fair to say that the stalwarts of our institutions, particularly politics in America and Wall Street and multinational free market capitalist corporations, are excessively hierarchical and patriarchal. For example, by percentage of elected officials, the U.S. is second to Japan with having the fewest women elected to office. And when you look at relational reality, is there not a feminine aspect to it? And what do you feel is the role of feminine studies today in helping with the transition relational understanding of our communities and schools and businesses?
Well, quickly, I think feminism has always challenged the power structure. But in relational reality, I do have a section in the last chapter of the book where I say, look, all these studies in psychology for decades have found that women tend to see field and background figures in a very gestalt way. We take in the contextual view, and the male participants in these studies tend to see the figure in the foreground and tune out the background. So this has always been used in psychology against us. Women were called field dependent, and the men were called field independent. But now that we have all this breaking evidence that reality is incredibly dynamically interrelated, it seems that the half of the human species that has a talent for seeing everything they look at in that interrelated gestalt contextual way, that talent is desperately needed by society. So at the very least, on every school board, city council, community organization, you really need at least half women present so that we can bring that perspective into things.
I absolutely agree. Let us continue our conversation in the near future at your convenience for a longer period of time.
Thank you very much.
Professor Charlene Spretnak, Spretnak. Her book is called Relational Reality, New Discoveries of Interrelatedness That Are Transforming the Modern World. Her website is charlenespretnak.com.